The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Incognito polling. Which political parties were secretly calling to your door? Has the chief medical officer got it wrong on antigen testing? Calls for Dr. Houlihan to explain his position. Do protections for renters go far enough? And we'll have a late diversion on political dynasties with Johnny Fallon. All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. But first the news with Shane McGowan. Thanks, Shane. Good evening and welcome to Wednesday's Late Debate. Joining us tonight, we have Patrick Costello, Green TD for Dublin and party spokesperson on justice, Michael Fitzmaurice, independent TD for Roscommon Galway, Lorraine Clifford-Lee, Fianna Fáil senator and Shannon spokesperson on health, and Daniel McConnell, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. We want to hear what you think, so get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Well, as you would have heard there in the bulletin, Fianna Fáil this evening became the latest party to admit to secretly using party activists to collect poll data door to door. This follows a report that Sinn Féin was engaged in this practice in today's Irish Independent and an admission by Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar that his party also did this in the past. First, let's hear Sinn Féin's Ón O'Brien responding to questions from Brian Dobson on the News at One earlier today.
You had members of your own party in your own constituency in Dublin West in advance of the 2016 election out on doorsteps pretending to be pollsters.
They were collecting polling data. But can I also say, Brian, if I had the resources and employed a private company, they wouldn't have been declaring that they were being employed to do the poll on behalf of Sinn Féin. It would have also been anonymised.
And here's Leo Varadkar speaking on Drive Time earlier.
This isn't something that we've done since 2016 or even before that, but certainly prior to that, we would have done something similar. Either volunteers or either volunteers would have been asked to do surveys door to door, or students would have been paid to do it, and would have been done on a similar basis, anonymised for the purposes of polling. But like I say, that practice has been discontinued. Certainly.
When did it stop?
Certainly 2016, 2017. I was trying to check that out earlier, maybe as far back as 2014, but certainly certainly not in the last five, six, 7 years.
And that was Leo Varadkar. And to complete the set, then we have a statement from Fianna Fáil issued this evening where they said that prior to 2007, we did on occasion use party members to undertake polling. And on those occasions, they did pose as market researchers. This was to supplement private providers also used. This practice was ended around 2007. Lorraine Clifford-Lee, first of all, Fianna Fáil gave a statement to The Independent on Saturday saying that the party does not and is not aware of any members or candidates carrying out opinion polls under the guise of fake market research companies. That would appear now not to be the case. And then earlier today, your colleague, Senator Mary Fitzpatrick, issued a statement saying that she was astounded to read that Sinn Féin activists were given detailed instructions on how to pose as researchers working for a polling company to covertly question voters. This is a direct quote from Mary Fitzpatrick from the statement. I'm of the view that any other political party would quite rightly be held to account if they were found to be using a similar strategy, and Sinn Féin should be no different.
Well, you said the statement came out from Fianna Fáil this evening. They obviously went back and really thoroughly researched the methods that were used, and they discovered a small amount of instances prior to 2007.
No, I don't know if it's a small amount.
They said it supplemented the data or the polling data done by private companies. So that would suggest it was a small amount. It was prior to 2007. What we're talking about with Sinn Féin was 2016. Now, we're a world apart in terms of our understanding of data. The GDPR directive was issued by the EU in 2015, and we would have been very aware, and the conversation would have started in relation to the importance of data.
So what was the
collection,
difference?
And particularly,
what's the difference between 2006 and 2016? Turning up at somebody's door and pretending
wrong.
From a company.
It is. I'm not defending that practice at all. It's completely wrong.
Well, Mark McSharry says it is extremely worrying. This is when he thought it was Sinn Féin was up to it. He found it extremely worrying. And I don't know anybody involved in politics up to now who would have engaged in subversion in the modern democratic world. And he couldn't see why it wouldn't constitute Gardaí involvement.
Well, you'll have to ask Mark McSharry about that statement, but I'm sure he didn't know that this was actually occurring within Fianna Fáil prior to 2007. But you have to put this in the context of what we know about the Sinn Féin ABOO system, and that's a really, really important overall context to put it in. There's one thing collecting data. There's another thing collecting data and collecting it from a number of different sources, pulling it together, putting it on a system. We don't know who is looking after this system. We know that Sinn Féin activists were encouraged to take data from social media and link that then with the voter register.
Well,
unfortunately, most importantly,
unfortunately, we don't have Sinn Féin in the studio tonight, so I can't put that. I know that Owen O'Brien earlier stated that
this
data was used anonymised. That's as much as
I can. Is it really? We know that Helen Dixon has written to Sinn Féin in relation to her deep concerns about the Sinn Féin linking social media profiles with the voter register.
We know that Helen Dixon is going to be in contact most likely with yourselves.
Absolutely.
In relation to this latest revelation.
And she should, because political preference data is highly sensitive, and nobody should be collecting this and putting it on an overall database and linking that with people's addresses. And that's why we're very concerned about it.
You're smiling. Would I say smirking there?
Yeah, look, this is just a political game that's going on, one hitting the other, trying to get one over the other. Mark McSharry is trying to be in opposition and in government. He has a comment on everything. He doesn't agree with most things the government does, but he goes in and votes on every single thing that he disagreed with a few days before it. All of this stuff went on and has gone on with all the political parties. Every TD...
Not with all the political parties now. Keane O'Callaghan says
with the main ones,
it has never had activists or students with the main ones, and Labour says to their knowledge.
Yeah, but every political party are independent. They have a register of electors in their area. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when we go for election, we never have to do a poll. Do you know why? Because we'd be friendly with the main parties, and they'd tell us how the polls were going. Because they're all the time polling, every one of them.
We use private companies, but we're not actually
you're constantly polling. But the bottom line on it is wrong for anybody to go in and say, I'm working with such a company, as in, say, a wrong impersonation of a person, and say to somebody, I'm working for someone, and they're being paid by be it Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin. That's what's wrong in the whole lot of this. Anyone can poll. Anyone is entitled to poll. I think Helen Dixon needs to get involved. This could be a bigger thing to look at. But look at, it's going on, and all that's going on at the moment, Katie, is we have bigger problems, to be honest about it, in the country. And all that's going on is trying to mudsling across at each other the way that in the next poll, Sinn Féin might come down a pint or two, or Fine Gael might go up a pint or two. And that's the whole game that's going on at the moment.
Patrick Costello, are the Green Party at this carry-on?
Not that I know of, and certainly I've never seen it in... I joined the party only in 2007, and I've never seen it in the party. I don't know, but certainly I've never seen it. Similarly, I would have been heard from other parties in the area. Oh, sure, look, you're on a grand thing. You should see what the local polls were doing and saying. I think if we look at the Sinn Féin instructions that went out, it was to pose as a made up market research company. And one question: if I was one of the other companies, established branded companies who trade on their brand and their trustworthiness, did anyone try and impersonate me? So I think that's a question that needs to be asked.
Well, I think that the name that they were given to supply was the Irish Market Research Association.
Which is made up. But with the other two parties, what are they doing? And look, this isn't new. Like, as I was talking to your researcher earlier, Showtime, the Pat Leahy books, he talks about Fianna Fáil doing this in 97. This is not, and using Ogra Sinn Féin at that, Ogra Fianna Fáil at that point. So
would have been a very good
kind of
practice. Ogre Sinn
Féin. This practice of polling and using internal volunteers for polling is not new. It's been around.
The ironic thing about it is that if you're out on the ground, you'll know how the wind is blowing. I remember the last election, and we could see it. My team that you have out, and what's happening in the big parties at the moment is that the half in the numbers of canvassers that they used to have one time in all the constituencies around the country. Which we could see it. I remember having about 500 canvassers around the place. And the feedback...
Sorry, you had 500 canvassers out for you?
Yeah.
In the last election?
Yeah, we done it in...
500?
Yeah. we'd done it in about, I don't know, 10 days or 12 days, the canvas. And I remember the wind was blowing. I remember talking to Michael Brennan, the journalist, one day he rang me and I said, Sinn Féin are rolling, they're starting to come. And at the time it wasn't seen. And you'd know it on the ground, the way the wind was blowing. And the main parties were lucky in the last election that the election came, because they were, Sinn Féin was on a roll at the time. And we could see that on the ground. We weren't experts at polling, but we could see it on the ground.
And I would bring in
Can I bring in, can I bring in Danny? Because I feel you're at a disadvantage not being in the studio. Daniel McConnell is in a remote studio, socially distanced from us. Daniel, how big a story is this?
Yeah, I think it's a significant story to the certain, particularly in relation to the Sinn Féin aspect of, you know, kind of essentially posing for a non-existent company. I think that is kind of an issue. I don't think Eoghan O'Brien satisfactorily dealt with that earlier on today. I think for the other parties...
But I mean, isn't that exactly what Fianna Fáil have said they did? That they did on occasion pose as market researchers.
Oh yeah,
is that not the exact same thing?
Well, I mean, just taking Lorraine Clifford Lee's point in relation to the timing of this, like, I mean, you know, 2007 is a slightly different context to 2016 when data and all the rest of it, we were moving to a GDPR regime and all the rest of it. I would, however, say all of this reinforces the need for an electoral commission. We need much clearer rules as to how elections are kind of orchestrated, handled and run. And it does show, I suppose, it does shine a spotlight onto the slightly murkier ways that politicians and political parties do their business.
Murky. Lorraine Clifford Lee. The murkier ways you do your business.
I absolutely think there is a big difference between doing a legitimate poll and then a political party taking that data and putting it onto an overall database and gathering data from loads of different points. And that's a very, very sinister system.
Okay, well, let me bring in do we have Ona Moroku on the line there? Yeah, we do. Eoghan, freelance journalist with tourisk.ie, and I suppose you won't mind me saying, a proud Republican, Eoghan O'Murachu. Take up that point for me that Lorraine was making there, that there's some difference between what Fianna Fáil was doing and what Sinn Féin was engaged in. Have we got Eoghan? We're not hearing Eoghan. Okay, sorry, bit of a problem with that line, but hopefully we'll be able to bring Eoghan in one moment. But in relation to, like, what is the, like, really, if the fundamental issue is that there was people, party activists, deceiving, knowingly
Katie,
deceiving
I think you
people
took me
outdoors.
Up wrongly there. What I was referring to was the type of polling that Michael was referring to. He was saying that... parties do polling on the ground, and that's completely legitimate. Yeah. I'm not trying to justify what Fianna Fáil did prior to 2007. Absolutely not. It was wrong then and it's wrong now. But I think the context in which the GDPR conversation had started in 2015 with the directive being issued from the European Union would have changed the context. And I'm very shocked actually to see that Sinn Féin and Fine Gael were engaging in this kind of behaviour back in 2016 and 2015.
Michael's laughing again. Eoghan O'Murachu, do we have you now?
You do indeed, yeah.
Yes, sorry about the line going down on us there, Eoghan. I don't know if you could have heard Lorraine there saying that she was shocked.
I had a good laugh at it, all right.
People will be... I mean, nobody likes to be fooled, to be taken for a fool. And people will be shocked, I think, that people who called to their door that they thought were genuine researchers, professional researchers, and they now find out they were talking to a political party.
Well, I think that the whole story, I think, is essentially a non-story. There's an exaggeration of what's involved here. First of all, the reason why you do this. Everybody knows when you knock on somebody's door, there's a strong tendency of the voters to say, we'll give you a stroke. And if you want to get a more accurate picture, you need something a bit more objective. The more money you have, you go to a professional company who do it, you know, in a very efficient way and a scientifically efficient way insofar as they put in weighting of the different social classes, age groups, etc. If you don't have that, you try and get it yourself together. At the end of the day, anybody who's asked to participate in an opinion poll of any kind, do you wish to do so? If you do, you do. If you don't, you don't. Now, as I think one of the points Eoghan O'Brien made, you quoted him earlier on, if Red Sea do a poll on behalf of Fine Gael,
They don't go to the voter and say, at the door and say, this is on behalf of Fine Gael. They say, this is Red Sea, we're doing a poll.
But, in that case, Owen, they are Red Sea and they are openly doing the poll. They're not there in front of you with a fake ID pretending to be from another company.
Well, I don't know that the ID was fake. If I set up a company or
but there was no company set up
research under the name or whatever it was.
But there was no
Irish
company set up.
Research Association, whatever.
But that company didn't exist. The company didn't exist. So it was a fake ID. It was an idea purporting to be from a company that didn't exist.
I've noticed this in the comments on it. Words like fake, polls, and so on are being bandied about. The question really is a very simple one. All political parties have a need to try and find out how things are going on the ground, what issues are concerning the electorate, and of course they change and develop their message accordingly. I think that as a story, it effectively died a death when it became clear that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have been, you know, doing the same thing. The nonsense that Lorraine was coming out with about there being a difference between 2007 and 2016, the Sinn Féin thing, as I understand it, was actually done in 2015. The one point I would make from the Irish independence story
Sorry, Owen, just to be clear, Owen O'Brien confirmed earlier today that it would have been used up in the run-up to the 2016 election in which he was elected, but he said it stopped happening sometime after that.
Yeah, I think the reason why you don't do it is, as I say, because it's unscientific. You can't do the weighting, which the professional pollsters are able to do because they know, you know, how they're going about it, so many from this class, so many from that age. So at the end of the day, I'm not sure how valuable all of this is. The one thing I would say is that in the independent story, they make the point that the Sinn Féin survey was remarkably accurate. In Donegal, it says in 2010, 36% of the people said they'd vote for Piers Dardy. He actually got 40%. The 2011 general election, Louth at 25% said they would vote for Gerry Adams. He got 22%. Those figures are pretty close to what was actually achieved. So even though it wasn't a professional outfit, it seems to have produced a reasonably professional result in terms of the data which it was able to analyse.
Okay. I should say, I suppose, that we did invite Sinn Féin to be part of our panel this evening, but no one was available. You wanted to respond there,
yeah,
Lorraine.
I did, because I suppose Owen is running with the line that Owen O'Brien has been running with all day, that there was nothing wrong done here, and it was like the little guy up against the big parties with loads of money, when we all know that Sinn Féin is the richest political party in this country and they have more money than all of us put together. So that is just a non-story. But for Sinn Féin to constantly just say that there was nothing wrong with this at all, I think everybody else has acknowledged that there is something wrong, and it was a flawed practice, and it doesn't give me much faith in their ability to see right from wrong in relation to personal data.
Just to give you a sense of what our listeners are saying to us, data that is collected unethically by not fully debriefing the participants is seriously flawed and needs to be questioned now. That's Claire and Roscommon. And sorry, but what is the issue with this type of polling? If people tell you who they're going to vote for, what difference does it make? Do you think the public is that concerned with this when there is so much more going on? And all the Fianna Fáil TDs were in the Dáil in 2006, so there's no digging for information. It's all in living memory. They were just trying to wait it out and hope it would blow over before they got egg on their faces. So I think we'll move on from this. Owen O'Murcu, many thanks for taking part on our discussion there. But we will move on, because Cabinet today has extended rental protections for those who self-declare that they have been financially impacted by the pandemic. This group can't face rent increases or eviction until the 12th of January 2022. Housing Minister Dara O'Brien described the response as proportionate and focused. However, opposition parties say the measures do not protect the vast majority of renters. Patrick Costello, your colleague Nessa Horrigan resigned the party whip because she believed that the government's residential tenancies and valuation bill, which is an earlier version of what was done today, didn't offer enough protection for renters. Do you think this measure goes far enough?
I think there are, that this measure is relatively limited. I think that we need to be finding more ways to protect people who are renting. And I, you know, I think that one of the fears is that we can't do more because of the power of the right to property in the Constitution. But I think we need to challenge that and to push that and to find ways in which we can protect people who are renting. And I think, look, in, there are longer term things we can do by amending the Constitution, which is something we've got the Greens pushed for and have got into the programme for government. We can build more public housing, which will ultimately help bring down, increase supply and bring down the cost of renting overall. But I think, yeah, I'll be talking with people in my party and the, my party in cabinet about how we need to do more to protect people who are renting.
Would you agree then with what Labour is saying today and the Soc Dems that this only protects 500 renters, and what Sinn Féin is saying indeed, this only protects 500 renters out of 300,000?
I wouldn't know the details. I don't know where they're getting that number from.
Well, that's the number of people who have self-declared as having been impacted by the pandemic. And though that's the only cohort of people that will be protected under, under this legislation.
Look, I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's the case or not. This is the first time I've heard that figure, so I don't know if that's the case or not. But I think that if that is true, then we need to be looking at the much wider range of people who have been impacted by COVID, who haven't perhaps been self-declaring, who maybe mightn't be on PUP but might be on reduced hours or things like that. So there's a wider cohort of people who do need protection,
and then and they're not getting it.
But there's
this.
There's a much wider thing of that rents are spiralling and that rents are excessive. And that our attempts, you know, by previous governments to introduce rent control legislation has been very limited. And a lot of that is built on a fear of litigation from landlords and, the, you know, a respect for the right to private property. And I think they're all things that need to be changed, but we do need to be doing more to protect renters. And it is a conversation I'll be having with my colleagues, yes.
Yeah, and just to say, that figure was the figure that was provided by the Housing Minister, Dara O'Brien, on the News at One earlier, that that's the number of people who have self-declared.
Self-declared, that's right. And I listened to what Dara O'Brien said there, and he also mentioned about closing the loophole before the end of the Dáil and Seanad term in relation to the 8% rent increases. So this has to be looked at in an overall suite of measures helping renters. And I agree with Patrick that a constitutional referendum is needed in relation to the right to housing. It's in the programme for government, and actually the Fianna Fáil senators last week tabled and got cross-party support for a motion in relation to the right to housing being inserted into the constitution, because we can only do so much when it comes to private property. But if that constitutional right to housing was in the constitution, we would be able to go much further. But this is has to be looked at in the context of rent supports.
What would you do if there was a that constitutional issue was no longer a barrier?
If the constitutional right to housing was there, it would allow, because there's a constitutional right to private property as well, and it would allow then a hierarchy of rights be created then, and the state could go further in relation to putting in supports and measures to protect renters.
Well, would you do rent freeze? Because that's what we keep hearing, that we can't have rent freezes, we can't put
controls on. Well, that's the legal advice, and yes, and I think the sooner we have that referendum, the better. I know the Minister has committed to setting up a housing commission, because there could be a number of things that could be brought together and put into the constitution rather than just the right to housing. But it is something that the government is totally committed to, and it's something I and my colleagues in the Fianna Fáil Seanad group are totally committed to, and that would overall protect renters to a greater degree.
Danny McConnell, do you think the government are really waking up to the idea that renters are not some kind of transient group that don't vote and are actually a real political force to be reckoned with now?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think, you know, for a long time, I think the political class, you know, didn't really care about renters because they were a smaller, much smaller subset of people. We have continuously failed to give renters proper protections, proper status, and kind of, you know, kind of given that European sort of safety net that you know, many of our counterparts on the continent enjoy. I think ultimately, though, as well, a lot of what Dara Bryan and successive housing ministers have sought to do in recent years amount to really nothing more than tinkering around the edges, because we have a fundamental disconnect or dysfunction within the market. And, you know, what we've seen from successive governments since the 1970s is a refusal to act on the Kenny report, which was a very, I suppose, far-reaching and radical report, which would have sought to redress that balance between the constitutional rights to private property, but also, you know, would have there was a key recommendation which would have allowed councils to compulsory purchase land, giving the kind of the current value plus 25%. But, you know, again, that report has sort of gathered dust, and ultimately, what we've seen is, you know, a complete insufficiency in terms of supply. We've seen kind of huge tracts of land being hoarded by developers and not developed. We've had local authorities refusing to exercise the powers that they have, and also not have sufficient powers to kind of force people to develop the land that they have. And all of this perfect storm has really crystallised over the last 10 years, given the failure of local authorities over the last 20 years or so to build sufficient social housing, even when we were in the middle of the crash 10 years ago. So you have this perfect storm that has come basically back to bite the political establishment, and now all of a sudden it's the sons and daughters of Fine Gael voters and Fianna Fáil voters who can't actually get on the property ladder. And, you know, one of the main elements of the social contract for people to buy into the system is the idea of getting a house in this country, and they can't do it. And that's why I think all of a sudden, you know, you're faced with this dilemma. And, you know, as I said, but the government, the solutions they're coming back with are piecemeal and are literally no more than tinkering around the edges.
Yeah, let me put that to Michael. Michael, this is the fifth attempt to tweak since this government came in, the fifth attempt, and as you mentioned there, there's talk of another go at it in the next month or so to deal with this rent hike that's on the way. I've just got a listener in saying, I'm facing into a potential 8% rent hike. These measures do nothing for those like me.
The minister has guaranteed that he will be doing something.
Well, he said he's looking at it.
Well, from what I picked up from him today, he said that he will be bringing measures in the next couple of weeks into the Dáil and Seanad. So that person there who tweeted your show won't be facing that 8% rent hike.
Katie, Daniel, exactly what he said is 100% right. They're tinkering around the edges for the last 5 or 6 years. This will not be solved unless it's a dysfunctional department. I've said this before on this programme, and I'm saying it again. A dysfunctional department. You have councils, you have housing bodies, and you have ordinary people bidding against each other for the same house. There is 35,000 sites around this country owned by the state. We have problems. I don't even think they're going to reach the targets next year or the year after. Do you know why? Because there's no trades available. If you were out there on the ground looking for people to do work at the moment, they're non-gettable. Plasters. Now
What are they doing?
They're not. There's no wet trades. The youngsters aren't going for wet trades at the moment. Huge problem. I've seen prices at the moment to build a bungalow out the country, just for the Blacklear, and it's about twice what it was 6 or 7 years ago. Plasters are gone to twice because they're not in it. And now there are companies looking at setting up. One has done it in Dundalk. There's another Derry Fada. There's a guy that I know is after buying Derry Fada, the Bournemouth place. And they're going into making steel structures in factories and making timber structures that they can put up
prefabricated.
Because if we don't go down that road, we're at nothing. You have to, you know, you can. The rent up until 2022 or whatever. We're just sort of doing bit by bit every 6 months. There's only one thing that will solve the rental problem in this country, and that's supply and demand. That's the total of it. And we are not doing anything for that at the moment. We have the amount of sites. We have to plan forward for other sites in the line of CPO. That should be done.
We've got politicians opposing. Like I live in Donabate in North County Dublin, and we have a big plan to provide.
You're right in what you're saying about politicians opposing. And I've seen cases going. You go at the moment on board Planola, and next thing it's gone to a judicial review. And there's judges asking what time of the year is shadow flicker, and they're sending back cases. And something needs to be done. Well, the one thing that needs to be done that any government can do this minute is call a housing emergency. And you can trump any law if you do that. And you can drive on and build wherever you want if you do that, if the will is there. But unfortunately, you'll have them from all parties and independents as well, that people will say, oh, Jesus, I don't want that at my back door. And until we call, if we pass a housing emergency and a government cause an emergency like a war, you can do what you want and build what you want. And we are going down the road then of letting one big builder build 600, 700, 800 houses. I saw some site in Dublin that there's going to be 1,200 houses.
That's where I live.
And it's going to be a 10-year project. That's 120 houses a year. Why don't we get the smaller builder and get them financed? Because there's a ferocious problem with our financing in Ireland, with the banking system. They're getting the money in from other countries. That's what's happening. There's investment companies that's financing most of the builders. Mm-hmm. If you're a big builder, you're getting it at 3, 4, 5, 6%. If you're the small operator, they're looking for 10, 12, 15%.
And in the community infrastructure has to be put in at the same time.
If we put in, but if the first thing you need is a house to live in. Because no matter if you have all the parks in the world, if you haven't
talking about basic services like roads and trains. Like you should.
There is 35,000 units around this country with service sites. We need to be planning for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's about giving Irish Water and the different bodies the money to make sure that we put that in. But we are at nothing with the way we're going on within in that department. And I've spoke about it before. At the moment, we have architects drawing up social housing. I draw it up a 3-bedroom in Galway. You draw it up in Dublin. They're two different houses. Why haven't we a 4-bedroom house, all the same inside, different facade out the front, and get rid of the architects that's doing all this twiddly-tallying with our boroughs?
What about the vacant site?
It's not just the architects. There's a lot more. Like, I'm a lot closer to being on the council, and the biggest block of the council building. Because a lot of the stuff you're talking about there, Michael, is the private providers and the private builders. But our local authorities should be building as well. And the biggest block to the local authorities building is the customs house, is the officials in the department getting in the way. Yeah. So they need to be getting out of the way and letting the councils...
A dysfunctional department.
Oh, and I totally agree with you on that.
But this is the other point. Let no one think that councils are fit to build houses at the moment. Do you know why? Because over the last 10 years, the numbers within in councils of the expertise has retired and they're gone. So what you need is, in my opinion, and the Land Development Agency, no way is it perfect, but what you need is to bring in deliverers from the private sector unpaid on what they put out, not on a big salary, no one from NAM or all them things, and given X amount of houses each, put a team around them and deliver it and hand it to the council. And unless we start doing that, you're going to go down the road of, first of all, the sites around this country are gone up nearly double because everyone is trying to bid for them. The councils are bidding for them. The housing bodies are bidding for them. Everyone is bidding for them. Second of all, when a house is ready, you have a young couple running in trying to buy it. You have the housing body running in and you have the council running in. And sure, we're all bidding against each other. What are we doing? Using state money. We are now driving houses to probably 50 to 60% more than what they should be if we knew how to do it right.
Okay, we'll leave that one there because we are actually going to have a special on housing on this programme.
Tomorrow night.
We just play back what you just said, Michael. And just before we move on, I want to touch on this Oireachtas Transport Committee today. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Hoolan called on to appear before the Dáil Committee to explain his opposition to the use of antigen testing. The Transport Committee heard from numerous experts today, including Dr. Michael Mina, who was a Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard University. He was asked about the CMO's stated position that antigen tests were only around 50% accurate. And this is his response.
It's just an inaccurate assessment if the goal, again, is to limit and block transmission, detect transmissible people. If these antigen tests were widely available and people had access to them, and in particular, if the government actually devised a program around them to say, you know, you have an event, use the test 2 hours before, you're going back to school, use the test twice a week, whatever it might be. These tests can absolutely keep spread down to an absolute minimum.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be kind of a slam dunk for antigen tests if we go along with this, you know, Harvard University epidemiologist. Where do you stand on this?
First of all, I know a few people in nursing homes that were worried until they got the vaccine that they would, and I know the HSE was doing it every 2 weeks, I think, and a lot of them went and they bought the antigen test. And thankfully, it saved them from the virus getting into the to the place. I'm no expert on this, and I'm not an epidemiologist or anything, but what I'm saying is there should be no reason why we shouldn't bring in Tolly Houlihan to give his view of it on the scientific side of it. If you listen to this guy today, what they're saying is that the antigen test won't work on 30 days or 20 days or 25 days or whatever, but it will show you
when you're at your most infectious.
When you're at your most infectious, and that it will save a certain amount. So I think that we are at a crisis at the moment in certain industries, be it the airline industry, and other sides of getting the country up and running, which we have to get up and running because we can't keep shut down the whole time. And I think we should bring them in. I don't think the comment that was used a while ago by one of the NEPID people about a snake or something was a great idea. But
this is Philip Nolan who was talking about snake oil when Lidl started selling.
I don't think you should cut the daylights out of anything. Okay. You should be open to look at it. And I think that if it helps an industry, great. But let's bring in Tony Houlihan to get his side. I think the guy in Harvard is fairly well qualified as well to give his view, in fairness to him.
Yeah, but I mean, I wonder what... I mean, Danny, you know, we know what Tony Houlihan's going to say because he's been asked about it often enough, God knows, at those NEPID briefings. We know that there's the Mark Ferguson report sitting there. We know what that says. It's extraordinary, really, that this argument just keeps going around in circles.
It is, but it does show that Tony Houlihan and those on the public health body in NEPID have a considerable amount of sway over our elected politicians.
Yeah.
You know, and that, to me, is not good enough. You know, we elect a government to govern, and these people advise, but yet the government have essentially outsourced the governing of the country over the last 15 months to public health officials. And you might say there was good reason to do that, but you know, we're in a different space now to where we were in December, in last October, and even last May. We now have, you know, a pretty effective series of vaccines that have changed the landscape altogether, and we're way behind our European counterparts, not only in terms of antigen testing, we're way behind in terms of opening up the country. And I just think, you know, for all those businesses who are out there listening to this, who have been clinging on week after week, I just think it's unforgivable. I think Tony Houlihan and NEPID have been given a very easy ride, have not been subjected to the proper scrutiny.
Will he come in, do you think? Will he go before this committee?
He might feel compelled to, because I'm sure at his next briefing, like, the top of the agenda is going to be antigen testing. He's going to be grilled on that. Now, like, the point has been made repeatedly, like, NEPID haven't just been, I suppose, cautious in relation to aviation. They've actually been hostile to the aviation sector in terms of their policy. They have been so dismissive.
They would argue that they are just being cautious.
I'm reflecting the views not only from politicians that I'm hearing, but I'm also reflecting the views from members of the aviation sector who have been furloughed for the last 15 months.
But it is the government's decision. All of this comes down to government decisions.
Yeah, but I suppose the point being made that I would hold, and many people, even within, you know, like Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on the backbenches, say their ministers have abdicated their responsibility for governing and have hidden behind the shelter and the shield of public health advice.
Okay, we're going to have to leave that there because I do a very special thing coming up after this break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. We're getting, as always, a huge reaction in again to any discussion we have on housing or renters. We have the lowest population density, yet the highest property prices in Western Europe, says one listener. Another listener says a good start in solving the problems for tenants would be if we stop electing landlords to the dole. With inflation at 1%, says another listener, why is the government allowing landlords to raise their rents by 4% a year? If this continues, rents will be almost double every 10 years. That's Jim from Cork. And Kieran Ferry is texting. I think Kieran is an architect who says, I think we can safely say that Michael Fitzmaurice has no time for architects.
I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is that we are going round in circles with drawings going from councils to custom house back again.
Right, okay, you've said it. Because I want to go to our late diversion, because we have a fascinating late diversion tonight on the very Irish practice of keeping politics in the family. We are talking about some of Ireland's biggest political dynasties, from the Lennons to the Healy Rays. And I'm joined now by the man who wrote a book about them, Johnny Fallon, Strategy Director with Cara Communications. You're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Katie.
what qualifies as a political dynasty?
Well, I suppose it differs in some people's minds because the one that jumps to, I think, everyone's mind is, you know, a couple of generations, maybe two, three generations of family, usually parent to child. And I suppose that is the most common type. But there are many other types as well, because really a dynasty is about a group of people exerting power, different members of the same family exerting power for a long period of time over a party, a place or a group of people. You would have to say as well that John and Richard Bruton, you know, are brothers, two brothers in that, but for the last 40 years they have been at the very heart of everything Fine Gael has done and every policy that's really come from the party. So you would have to include them too as a dynasty. It's a dynastic power.
And do we have an unusually high number of political dynasties in Ireland?
We do, but it's not an unusual fact in the sense that lots of other countries have them. There are just more opportunities because we have a multi-party system and there are several seats in the same constituency, so parties can get several family members elected. Whereas in some other countries, it's harder, much harder to get where you've single-seat constituencies or first past the post. The Seanad has also been another great way for families to bring another member in, or if a seat is lost, to retain seats and keep family names in the public consciousness.
Are politicians born, not made? They grow up in a political environment that can be very, very different to normal family life.
It's a completely different scenario. And I suppose for political parties too, there's always this thing of, you know, what is a politician? It is that there's the element of showbiz. So name recognition carries a lot. The advantage the parties have with the dynastic politician is it's a name people know, but that person knows exactly what they're getting into, unlike maybe a celebrity candidate. They know there's a lot of mundane work. I become public property. They're used to seeing family, you know, interrupted by the fact that people are calling to the house. There's maybe constituency meetings, and that they're not maybe always there for the family. That doesn't come as a shock to them.
And I've had that conversation with a lot of politicians who were, as you say, second generation in Leinster House. And it always astonishes me that they went into it, you know, with their eyes wide open and knowing the havoc that it caused their life, you know, growing up.
It is, and it's definitely one of those things that becomes like a family business. I mean, it's like the way some people might say, you know, doctors don't have an easy job, yet generations of family go on to be doctors or pharmacists or whatever it is that is the family profession. Politics becomes like that. It becomes a way of life, I think, for many families, and they want to continue on the name and tradition. Although I will say that in the generational thing, it's unusual for somebody to surpass the achievements of, say, their parent in politics. It has happened, but it's unusual. Usually the trend setter tends to be that after that, dynasties tend to wane a little bit in terms of influence. It's difficult to emulate it generation after generation. Of course, some would say that the likes of the Lenehans booked that trend, where maybe later generations did get higher ministerial portfolios, but it is unusual.
Yeah, let's talk about the Lenehans, because I would say that for many people, when they think Irish political dynasties, they think the Lenehans, because it was multi-layered and multi-generational. I think we've pulled together a few clips: Brian Senior, Mary O'Rourke, Connor and Brian Junior.
It's easy for you to be cynical and sceptical about the motivation of people who went to public life. I have never ever tried to advance my own self-interest in my public life today. I never will.
I never minded that he didn't promote Brian. Why should he? He doesn't have to promote anyone.
He's borrowing to ensure that social welfare recipients are paid, that pensioners are paid, that salaries are paid in the public service.
Well, I want to say that I'm absolutely certain, on mature recollection at this stage, that I did not ring President Hillary. And I want to put my reputation on the line in that respect.
What was unusual about the Lenehans?
They built a foundation that was on this big, strong personalities, always filling the room. Incredibly loyal. Brian Lenehan Sr. built something on that, that, you know, he didn't go against his leader, didn't go against it. Loyal to a fault, many people would have said, over his career. And you saw that kind of come through again in other members of the family, even Brian Jr., who, you know, there was all that talk that Bertie Ahern maybe didn't favour him, but he stuck with it, went with it. And they always had this sense that they were a family that could get on with the man in the street, as well as having that kind of power.
The story about Brian Jr. was that he would hear from people that always made time to talk to them.
I remember talking to a Labour TD who was elected after 2007, who said to me that, you know, he brought his parents to the Dáil and was bringing them around Leinster House and showing them, and everybody was in such a rush, people were running one place and another, but he happened to bump into Brian Lenehan. He introduced himself, he met his parents and was whisked off because people were talking about ministries and pressures. But later on that day, Brian Lenehan sought him out, sat down, said to his parents, "Must be a very proud day for you, your son, you know, getting into the Dáil." And he said, just took the time, even though he was from a different party. And that was kind of the trademark that was very much part and parcel of the family.
You had a chat with Brian Senior yourself.
I did. Again, coming from a family who was very much into politics, I was dragged along to Ardeshena from I was a small child. And, you know, you went in the old days, you had to hold the seats, and that would have been my job. And I remember being about eight, nine years of age, sitting at an Ardesh, minding the seats in the RDS, while there's nothing happening on stage because people are just milling about and going to workshops and everything else. And then I was aware of somebody coming behind me, grabbing me by the shoulders and saying, "Aren't you a great young man?" And when I turned around, it was Brian Lenehan Senior. And he came around, sat beside me on the seat, and immediately sat down and said, "What do you think of what's going on in the government now?" And of course, I started pontificating as an eight-year-old kid, thinking this is great to do it. But, you know, he sat there and listened as if he was talking to another adult. And it was an amazing experience. But that was, as I say, that trademark.
There's more dynasties growing as we sit here. And I suppose the most successful current political dynasty is the one down my neck of the woods in Kerry, the Healy Rays.
An unusual maybe dynasty in that Jackie Healy Ray, when he was there, was again Fianna Fáil, Jean Poole down there, party worker down there, looking for a seat, looking for a nomination. And maybe a lot of people in Fianna Fáil at around that time of the late 90s, the party was moving on from that kind of TD and was, you know, a new Fianna Fáil was being born. And they didn't kind of see maybe Jackie Healy Ray as a proper candidate, meaning he ran as an independent and upset all the odds.
Jackie Healy Ray told me himself of how Bertie Ahern let him down.
Yeah.
With a bang, as he might put it himself. I think we've a clip of Jackie, of course, the patriarch of the Healy Rays, on a favourite topic of his own and indeed of other Healy Rays, of how drink driving laws are destroying the fabric of rural Ireland. And we also have a clip of Michael Healy Ray having a go at the begrudgers.
"This village, there were 6 or 7 bands in it one day. There's one there about closed.
Jack Rogers.
Jack Rogers is closed and the village is closed. Poor Katie came home. There'll be no hope. I always mentioned 2 to 3 points. There are 100% safe after that didn't beat the right down.
And these people who will be up now tonight at 2, 3, and 4 o'clock explaining to the nation how horrible the Healy Rays are, I have a message for you. Get up tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. Go away and do something productive. And don't mind wasting your time staring into miserableness, writing horrible things about people who don't even know."
All Jackie wanted actually was a Fianna Fáil nomination. Mm-hmm. So it was when he realised that wasn't going to come his way. And he had spent his young years in politics helping other people get elected. He was the master of the razzmatazz, the rallies ahead of elections. And now he found himself left behind.
Yeah, it was, as you say, a generational thing where maybe, you know, he had been the mastermind behind an awful lot of the party work, as so many are in political parties across the country. These people on the ground who really are the power brokers, they're so resilient, they're so strong because they know they're speaking to a group who really feel that, you know, life is passing us by and we don't want it. And there's always a sense of, go up and show them crowd in Dublin exactly what we're about down here and we don't have to take it from them. And building that brand, I mean, Michael Healy Ray is so like Jackie in the way he goes on and the way he has presented himself. It is a brand now. And people buy into that brand and they feel security in it. And moving away from it becomes very, very difficult for them as a choice for a voter when it's something you feel has worked for you and has delivered for you.
Tell me about the donkey.
I think this was covered in one of your own books, Katie, on this, but it was Jackie Healy Ray, you know, going out. And this shows you just how intent they were on getting votes and what it takes to be that kind of politician. And he asked a woman for the vote and she said, "No, I won't give you the vote because I met you in the pub and I told you I had a donkey that needed to be castrated. You said you'd find someone to do it. You never did. I never heard from you. It's 2 days to go to voting. You're not getting the vote." And he said, "I'll find someone." She said, "No, you won't. You won't find them in 2 days. You're not getting the vote. That's that." And apparently, you know, the day before voting, Jackie turns up at the house and performs the castration himself in order to get that vote. And it's that sense of going that extra mile at a local level when you have to.
Indeed. Indeed. OK, we touched on the Bruton brothers because, you know, in Fine Gael terms, they would be really an iconic name. Mm-hmm. the Andrews family, another big name.
In a slightly different sense, they had that real patriotic kind of attitude, I suppose, towards the family in Todd Andrews, who was a civil servant, if you like, and in the semi-state sector, but a big name within Fianna Fáil. And then you had David Andrews, when he became a minister, foreign minister, well-respected, stood up to Charles Haughey, not an easy thing to do, was left out in the wilderness for years. If you were to look for the royalty within Fianna Fáil, you'd be looking at the Andrews and saying, there's the people that go all the way back, you know, to the fight for freedom and everything else. And they create that dynasty, brothers again in that sense, but then they have a new generation, Barry coming into it as a junior minister. You know, again, Fianna Fáil is very linked to a lot of those dynasties. But of course, you also have now Chris Andrews, who left Fianna Fáil and is now in Sinn Féin as a TD.
And of course, Charlie Haughey set about building a dynasty through marriage.
For somebody like Charles Haughey, who came into it at a time when, you know, there was a lot of new men. The men in the mohair suits was the term. But in Fianna Fáil in particular, you still needed to be able to touch those august heroes of the past. Charles Haughey came into it very much as a new man, very much liked by grassroots, did all the chicken and chip circuit. He needed that touch of gold dust, though. And of course, to marry into the Lammas name, that was absolutely what he had. And his own son, Sean, is now a TD. And, you know, famously, there is a great story of Charles Haughey one time, you know, throwing a party when he was with Sean Lammas. And Sean Lammas said to him, that was a very big party. It must have been very expensive. And I said, it was, but it was worth it, you know, for you and for everyone to enjoy. And he said, must have cost you 200 quid. And he said, the guts of it. And Lammas went off kind of quite upset by this, saying that's an awful lot. And Charlie said, I didn't like to tell him it was closer to 2,000. And that was perhaps a changing of the guard.
Politics is changing. Looking 10, 20 years, would we still have this style of politics where the family name, that brand, will carry so much sway?
I think so. I think you'll always have it because it's, again, a bit like celebrity. It's you will always have celebrities, you'll always have big names that come into it. What we have in vote when we go to vote is a little bit like a security blanket. We expect certain values from people, and we like to think that if you carry the same name as your parents or another family member, you must have some similar values, and therefore you'll deliver for me the same way as your predecessor, who I trusted or loved or liked, delivered for me. And we trusted them before, we'll trust them again. And it's easier. We work in Ireland very much on a system of favours, and it's much easier to hand a favour down across your family lines than it is across party lines.
And that was Johnny Fallon. They're taking us through all those political dynasties. Michael Fitzmaurice, are you grooming somebody?
No. I actually don't agree with Johnny Fallon that, yes, down through the years, first of all, there wasn't a mobile phone years ago and 30, 40 years ago. And I would see, or my opinion is that I cannot see generations coming by for the simple reason. Politics is a pretty demanding life. When you put yourself in, you put yourself full hog at it. When your family, you know, like I've youngsters at home, turned to notion of them ever going near politics for the simple reason you have missed the matches, you have missed the different things that you were supposed to be at. They would, in my opinion, have a bit of sort of resentment towards politics for the simple reason you're gone the
but
whole
sure,
time.
But sure, that was the same with Brian and Conor Lenehan Jr.
Correct, but it's there is nowadays youngsters, they're not going to put themselves in for the likes of that, or they see the likes of Facebook and the trolling that goes on late at night and what's said about their father or their mother or their aunt or their uncle. It's going to be a dirtier type of game with some of the stuff you see coming, and I think youngsters, they don't want that anymore.
Danny?
Yeah, I certainly agree with Michael Fitzmaurice. I was just thinking there of Jackie Healy Ray. One of the great stories I heard about him was that in his last term in the Dáil, the then Chief Whip Pat Kerry told me that they actually closed business early up on a Thursday to allow Jackie go home on the train to Killarney. And it was just the power that he had at that independent, as an independent over that Cowan government, was just phenomenal, you know. And he had Seamus Brennan and other Chief Whips doing his bidding. But I wouldn't necessarily agree with Johnny Fallon either, like, I mean, in terms of like the kind of the newer generations not doing better than the fathers. I mean, the classic example of that now is Helen McEntee, who made it to the senior cabinet ranks, where her late father, Shane, only made the junior ranks. So, but in terms of like the nastiness of politics, without question, like it's a much nastier. Like I think any of the politicians on the panel this evening can detail the trolling abuse that they would have gotten from the lovely people on Twitter and Facebook and everything like that. But I think, you know, whereas 40 years ago I think there was a reverence around politicians and, you know, that's the sort of esteem that they would have been held in, I certainly don't get the sense that politicians are held in the same level of esteem that they were. And the attraction of the job, I just don't think it's there.
Okay, sorry to cut across you, Danny, but I'm right. I'm actually over time now, but I'll take that last break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And that's all we have time for. A reminder again, we have a housing special tomorrow, so please join us for that. It's our last show of this season. Producer tonight was Caroline Dalton, research by Andrew Fleming, broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Jamie Doyle was on sound. I want to thank my panel. Thank you all for listening. And with apologies for being a little late, I'll hand you over now to Col Murray on Late Date.